House in and for the 7th Judicial Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument is United States versus McCarter. Mr. Petro.
Good morning, sirs.
Good morning.
As an opening point, Judge, if you accept Ms. Cahill's testimony as true in this case, what you have is a robbery of a private person in Oak Park of $13. Given those facts, Judge, there's obviously no direct and substantial effect on interstate commerce. In this particular case, clever indicting by the government has turned a crime that has no effect on interstate commerce into an attempt crime where there's a potential effect on interstate commerce. Because of that, Judge, I don't think that there is an interstate commerce nexus here for the Hobbs Act robbery.
Because it's an attempt?
Because it's an attempt, Judge.
Well, no.
The second argument I have, Judge, is that there is no language in the indictment that would support the substantial step that are alleged by the government in this case. In Russell v. United States, a Supreme Court case, it does say specifically that there must be enough factual particulars in an indictment to apprise a defendant of what he must be prepared to meet. In this particular case, Judge, the words substantial step are not used. Secondly, there are no facts in the indictment which would apprise the defendant of what the substantial step is that he must prepare to defend himself from. Given the clever indicting in this case thus far, Judge, it would seem to me
there
that...
There are three judges here. I don't understand you keep intoning judge.
Judges.
Are you addressing just one of us or what?
I'm looking straight ahead, sir. I apologize. Because there is no language indicating what the factual predicates for a substantial step are in this particular case, the government has not alleged a sufficient element of the crime. The Seventh Circuit jury instruction is clear that substantial step must be alleged, must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. It is an element of the crime. The pattern jury instructions in United States versus SIA specifically say that there must be a substantial step alleged and it must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. My third argument is, Judge, that in this particular case, the substantial step was not proven. In this particular case, the government never showed that the defendant ever made a substantial step towards going to the ATM machine. Specifically, Ms. Cahill was asked, the victim in this case, specifically, did the person ever specify where you were going? No, he did not. Did he ever give you specific direction to direct your car? No. Did he ever tell you specifically that you were going to a bank? No. Did he ever specifically tell you that you were going to an ATM machine? No. I go back to my original argument, Judge. What you have here, judges, my apologies. I go back to my particular argument, sirs, that in this particular case, what you have is a robbery of a private citizen. And because it's a robbery of a private citizen, I must point out the only reason that there's a federal case in this particular case is that the state court armed robbery statute of limitations had expired. This case, from the time that it came in, was investigated by the Oak Park Police Department. At the time that the case happened, fingerprints were run into the computer, and it's clear from the testimony of the fingerprint expert that he did not even consult the FBI database at that time to find a match for whoever the fingerprints belonged to. 5 years later, after the state statute had expired, the government alleges an attempt crime instead of a robbery, which it is a robbery of $13 if you believe Ms. Cahill, And the reason they allege the attempt crime is because they want to get past the interstate commerce nexus problem. My fourth argument was the theory of defense instruction. Specifically at that time, I did provide a theory of defense instruction. The theory of defense instruction was an accurate statement of law and should have been given to the jury at that time. It specifically clarified the issue that the fingerprints should have been left at the time of the crime. There was substantial disagreement as to when the fingerprints were in fact left in that particular place. More critically, in my sixth argument, I asked specifically at that time for an eyewitness instruction. While neither of the victims apparently did not identify the defendant in this case directly, the fact that they did make substantial eyewitness recollections at the time of the offense would indicate that the eyewitness jury instruction should have been given. In this particular case, it's clear that the eyewitness instruction was asked for by the defendant and was not received by the court. This is clear error, and the Seventh Circuit pattern instructions in their notes state clearly and succinctly that if the defendant asked for an eyewitness instruction, he should receive it. The final argument that I have...
Wait a minute. Wait. Pause. She didn't identify him, did she?
No, she did not. Neither.
So there was no eyewitness.
Well, there were eyewitnesses that testified as to the description of the person, and in this particular case...
But nobody identified him as an eyewitness.
I think that the instruction is broader than that.
No. If there was no eyewitness, why would you give an eyewitness instruction?
Because the eyewitnesses still made...
We're starting with the wrong premise. There was no eyewitness, was there?
As far as someone that would come into court and directly identify the defendant...
That's what an eyewitness is.
Okay. That is correct. But they did have perceptions at the time that led to the identification of this particular...
But is that an issue, that this incident occurred in the garage and this person was seen? I don't understand.
There was a person...
You want the jury to believe that this incident had not occurred?
The incident did occur, clearly,
yes,
Judge.
So,
it's an identification case.
So what is it about these witnesses' testimony that you wanted the jury to disbelieve?
Well, specifically the height issue. The complaining witness in this case identified the person clearly and specifically as a person that was 5'8" tall. My client was 6'2" tall. They were close, they were right next to each other, and she said the man was exactly the same height I was. That is the type of thing that I'm referring to, Judge.
Well, then you don't want an eyewitness instruction. You ought to be happy with what you've got. You've got a witness who misdescribes whoever it was that's on trial. They ought to rest quietly with that one and beat it up in final argument, which you don't need an instruction that the eyewitness doesn't know. You want to say, she obviously made a mistake. I assume that's what you said, and you're into your rebuttal time. So,
thank you, Judge.
How tall was the FBI agent? Was the FBI agent who told him to act like a gentleman?
5'4" tall, I believe.
Thank you. Mr. Pope?
Good morning. Contrary to what the appellant's counsel suggests, this is not just a local crime. What you have here is a robbery that affected interstate commerce if it had been completed. It was charged in an attempt, and defense counsel attempts repeatedly to read the attempt provision out of the Hobbs Act robbery. He cites no case law to support that position, and it should be rejected by this court. In addition, the arguments to that substantial step, the two words substantial step, need to be placed into an indictment finds no basis in case law whatsoever. Instead, for an indictment to be sufficient, the indictment must track the statutory language, which there is no dispute that this indictment tracked the statutory language for both the Hobbs Act and for the bank robbery statute. Therefore, it's sufficient. Unless your honors have any questions, specific questions for me, the government is prepared to stand on its briefs.
Well, do you want to say anything about the Booker issue?
Nothing that hasn't already been said numerous times in this court over the past two weeks.
Is the sentence based in part on a judge's fact findings?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Have there been other cases that have reached appellate courts, at least, where bank robbery has been charged on facts like this?
Not that I could find.
Why was it done in this case?
The office took a look at this case, unquestionably, a long, hard look at this case, and decided to charge both the Hobbs Act and the attempted bank robbery case. We do believe that it fits into the plain language of the bank robbery statute, and made the decision to charge accordingly.
Can both stand? Can both convictions stand?
Absolutely, both convictions can stand.
What's the premise of the Hobbs Act conviction?
The premise of the Hobbs Act conviction was that the robbery if completed, money would have been taken out of that ATM machine. That money would have ultimately come, no question, from Ms. Cahill's bank account back at Midwest Bank. Money can both be in a bank account, an individual's bank account, and be in the care, custody, and control of that financial institution.
So that's the tension. Is the Hobbs Act premised on a theft from her or theft from the bank?
Theft from her.
So you're finding this man guilty of theft from her and theft from the bank?
Absolutely. And as I mentioned, it can be both in the control of the individual victim and in the victim bank, because it is in the care, custody, control under the plain language of the statute. If there are no further questions, the government will rest on its brief.
Thank you, Mr. Paul. Mr. Petro, how much time does he have? 2 minutes? Okay, have anything further?
I would just like to address the Booker issue briefly. In this particular case, if you read the government's brief, they concede that the sentencing in this case, there was plain error. What they're saying in their third argument is that the record does not indicate that the district court considered the guidelines as advisory as rather than mandatory. In this particular case, if you look at the transcript from the sentencing hearing, I point out a number of issues that the judge did consider the guidelines as mandatory. Specifically, we asked to put on live testimony, and she responded, "What for? That's not going to make any difference. I'm not going to do that. The guidelines are what the guidelines are." At some point, they asked to put a statement, the government asked to put the statement of the victim into the record, and she stated, "There are sentencing guidelines that really don't give me discretion to make that choice. I am not going to have the people come up here and argue this, and there is no point." As to whether the advisory nature of the guidelines would have made a difference in this particular case, the court further goes on and states in the transcript, based on defendant McCarter's statement to the court states on the mitigation side, the fact that 5 years has passed since this offense makes a difference in one respect. There is no history of anything happening during that 5 years in time, and so there is no reason to believe that indeed that the defendant had begun to live a different life. So this sentence, in that sense, is particularly harsh. In this particular situation, it's clear that the guidelines were mandatory. Clearly, it would have made a difference if she would have had a range and could have considered or would have been able to consider all the factors in 3553. Thank you.
What was the sentence? I forgot.
15 years.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Petro. And you were appointed, were you not?
I was appointed on the next brief, Judge. I was retained on this one. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Thank you to both counsel. Next case for argument, United States.